purchased by Lewis in St. Louis. Mounted on a swivel that allowed it to be turned and fired in any direction, it was the expedition's heaviest armament and in 1804 would be the largest weapon to that date ever taken up the Missouri. It could fire a solid lead ball weighing about 1 pound, or 16 musket balls, with sufficient velocity to go through a man. At close range, a highly effective anti-personnel weapon. In addition to the swivel cannon, Clark asked Lewis to get 4 smaller weapons called blunderbusses, heavy shotguns that used buckshot. Lewis found them in St. Louis. Clark mounted them on swivels, 2 for the stern of the keelboat and 1 on each pirogue. They could be loaded with musket balls, scrap iron, or buckshot. At close range, devastating. In early February, Lewis crossed over to the camp at Wood River. He looked over the men, there were nearly 40 of them, and listened as Clark explained what he had done to the keelboat. Clark then left to spend a few days in St. Louis to make purchases and to attend a ball at the Chouteaus. Lewis had intended to join him at the ball, but was obliged to stay in camp to meet with some visiting Kickapoo Indians. Having missed the ball, he wrote Clark, and finding more to do when I began to look about me than I had previously thought of, I determined it would be as well to go to work here at Wood River and postpone my return to St. Louis a few days. He wanted Clark to talk to Pierre Chouteau about the possibility of his leading an expedition of Osage chiefs to Washington. Clark's tasks in St. Louis included picking a crew of voyagers to paddle the canoes, the captains by now having decided to keep the permanent detachment, the Corps of Discovery, together as a unit on the keelboat. Clark, who had once descended the Mississippi to Memphis and who had lived on the Ohio River for many years, was the better waterman of the two captains, and thus probably the better judge of the voyagers. Clark talked to Manuel Lisa, who was ready to contract out a crew that he would select and organize. Lewis wrote Clark, "Engage them immediately if you think from their appearance and characters they will answer the purpose." Lisa was doing quite a lot of business with the expedition. He paid a visit to Wood River to see what the captains didn't have that he did. Lewis dined in his home, although he most often stayed with Auguste Chouteau in the finest house in town. On February 20th, Lewis prepared to shove off for St. Louis. He issued his first detachment orders, putting Sergeant John Ordway in command during his and Clark's absence, and directing the sawyers to continue their work, the blacksmiths to continue their work, with an extra gill or 4 ounces of whiskey and exemption from guard duty, the men making sugar to continue to do so, and so forth. To save powder and lead, he ordered only 1 round per man per day for target practice. Sergeant Ordway would give instructions in shooting offhand at a distance of 50 yards. There was a prize of an extra gill of whiskey for the winner each day. Except for hunters, no man was to absent himself from camp without Sergeant Ordway's knowledge and permission. Finally, no whiskey beyond the legal ration. Lewis went off to St. Louis, conducted business, and returned a week later. Sergeant Ordway reported to him that Privates Reuben Field and John Shields had refused to mount guard duty as ordered because they would be damned if they would take orders from anyone other than the captains. Privates John Coulter, John Boley, Peter Weiser, and John Robinson had gone off hunting, or so they had told Ordway, who had tried to stop them. In fact, they went to a neighboring whiskey shop on the edge of the nearby American settlement and got drunk. To deal with these disciplinary matters, Lewis wrote another detachment order dated March 3rd in the journal. "The commanding officer feels himself mortified and disappointed at the disorderly conduct of Field and Shields, especially since he had thought of them as excellent soldiers and men of judgment." He went on, "A moment's reflection must convince every man of our party that the captains had to be in St. Louis to gather the necessary supplies and equipment for the voyage. When they were gone, Sergeant Ordway was in command. Period." Lewis confined Coulter, Boley, Weiser, and Robinson to quarters for 10 days. On March 7th, Lewis returned to St. Louis to be present at the ceremonies marking the formal transfer of Upper Louisiana to the United States. Captain Stoddard, the official American representative, invited Lewis to serve as the chief official witness. There was a detachment from the 1st Infantry Regiment out of Fort Kaskaskia on hand. The ceremony took place on March 9th in front of Government House, Spanish headquarters in the city. First, a transfer was made from Spain to France. Colonel de Lassus presided for Spain, while Stoddard acted as agent for the French. When the Spanish flag was struck, de Lassus presented it to Stoddard, who then ran up the French tricolor. The crowd, composed of nearly all the residents of St. Louis, most of them French, cheered. With tears in their eyes, Frenchmen asked Stoddard to let the tricolor wave over St. Louis for one night. Stoddard agreed. The next day, to the salute of guns and cheers from the soldiers, the tricolor was lowered and the Stars and Stripes was raised, the documents were signed, and appropriate speeches were made. Stoddard assumed the post of military civil governor of Upper Louisiana, pending the establishment of territorial government. After the ceremonies, Lewis and Clark accompanied Stoddard on an inspection of Spanish defenses. A few days later, Clark returned to Wood River to continue preparations. The days were getting noticeably longer, the first hints of opening buds were on the tree limbs, the great duck and geese migrations were just starting, the ice no longer ran in the river, spring was coming. And with the first warm days came an ominously unwelcome visitor. On March 25th, Clark wrote in his journal, "The mosquitoes are very bad this evening." On March 28th, Lewis drew three drafts or checks of $500 each on the Secretary of War. He had already drawn $1,669 and drew an additional $159 a few days later. He was also drawing money to provide for the Osage Chief and Pierre Chouteau on their trip to Washington, and he was signing chits for supplies. Altogether, signing his name to a draft on the government was becoming a commonplace experience for Lewis. Indeed, it was threatening to become habit-forming. On the afternoon of the 29th, Lewis crossed over to Wood River. Clark had alarming news. There had been fights between the men. John Shields had opposed an order and had threatened Sergeant Ordway's life and wished to return to Kentucky. John Coulter had disobeyed orders and had loaded his gun, threatening to shoot Ordway. The men had been at Wood River for the better part of 4 months. They never got to go to St. Louis. The only women they saw were the pioneers at the nearby settlements, and there weren't many of them, and mostly they were married. There was a whiskey cellar around, but he was expensive and hard to get to. Once the huts were completed and the keelboat's alterations were finished, the men had almost nothing to do. A little drilling on the parade ground, which they hated, a little target practice, which they loved but only got to do once a day, was about it. These young heroes were in great shape, strong as bulls, eager to get going, full of energy and testosterone, and bored. So they fought and drank and fought. Clark recorded various serious fistfights, sometimes with delightful comment. "Our field was in a mistake and repents. Frazier has done bad." But fighting among themselves was one thing, threatening the sergeant quite another. On March 29th, the captains put Shields and Coulter on trial for mutiny. The privates asked the forgiveness, etc., and promised to do better in future. The captains relented. No punishment was noted. And 2 days later, Shields and Coulter were welcomed into the permanent party. On March 31st, after a full exchange of views between themselves, the captains held a ceremony in order to enlist the 25 men they had selected to be members of the detachment destined for the expedition through the interior of the continent of North America. Another group of 5 soldiers was designated to accompany the expedition to its winter quarters, then to return to St. Louis with communiques and specimens. Corporal Richard Warfington would be its leader. The main detachment was divided into 3 squads. Charles Floyd and Nathaniel Pryor joined Ordway as sergeants commanding the squads. Warfington, Floyd, and Pryor were not the only soldiers who had impressed the captains. Pryor was sick. In the detachment order recording the selections, Clark wrote, "During the indisposition of Sergeant Pryor, George Shannon is appointed, pro tempore, to discharge the said Pryor's duty in his squad." Since Shannon was not yet 20 years old, the youngest man in the party, that appointment was a genuine compliment. The permanent party was now in place. Besides the 22 men and 3 sergeants, it included Lewis and Clark, Clark's slave, York, Driard, and Lewis's dog, Seaman. It was straining to get going. Every morning, the men looked across the Mississippi and saw the Missouri pouring into the main stream, so powerful its muddy waters drove clear across three-quarters of the width of the mighty Mississippi, the Missouri being the more powerful of the two. Clark also recorded, "I send to the Missouri's water for drinking water, it being much cooler than the Mississippi." In the evening, the men could watch the sun go down over the Missouri. Surely, as they sipped their whiskey ration at the end of the day, they stared at that river and talked about it and thought about it. They were not daunted by it. Rather, they were drawn to it. What adventures awaited, what sights they would see, they knew they couldn't even guess, which only made them all the more eager to get going, so they could find out. Sergeant Gass wrote in his journal that the local inhabitants had warned that the party was to pass through a country possessed by numerous, powerful, and warlike nations of savages of gigantic stature, fierce, treacherous, and cruel, and particularly hostile to white men. But, he insisted, the determined and resolute character of the men and the confidence pervading all ranks dispelled every emotion of fear. A week after the ceremony of enlistment, Ordway wrote his parents. He expressed determination and confidence. "We are to ascend the Missouri River with a boat as far as it is navigable, and then to go by land to the Western Ocean, if nothing prevents, etc. This party consists of 25 picked men of the army and country, and I am so happy as to be one of them picked men. We are to start in 10 days, April 18th, up the Missouri River. We expect to be gone 18 months or 2 years. We are to receive a great reward for this expedition when we return." Ordway said he would be drawing $15 per month in pay and would receive a bonus of 400 acres of prime land. Then he reported what may have been just another soldier's rumor or an expectation encouraged by the captains. Whichever it was, it spoke to the spirit of the men and their captains. "If we make great discoveries as we expect, the United States has promised to make us great rewards more than we are promised, etc." Chapter 11. Ready to Depart. April to May 21st, 1804. As the April sun grew warmer, the banks of the Mississippi exploded into color. Green gold, nature's first hue, predominated early in the month, but it had serious competition. The captains noted spicewood in full bloom on April 1st, along with the white dogtooth violet and the mayapple. On the 5th, the buds of the peach, apple, and cherry trees, imported by the pioneers, appeared. By the 17th, they were in full bloom. Osage apple and Chickasaw plum were in flower, along with the violet, the dove's foot, and the cowslip. It was gorgeous weather, with afternoon temperatures climbing into the 60s and, by the last week of the month, into the low 70s. But on the 26th, a frost killed fruit at Cahokia. St. Louis escaped without damage. That afternoon, the temperature was up to 66. "Let's go," one can almost hear the men of the Corps of Discovery crying out to the captains. "Let's go, for God's sake." Lewis decided no, not yet. Sometime between April 8th, when Sergeant Ordway wrote that the expedition would be off on April 18th, and mid-April, Lewis concluded that he needed far more in the way of provisions, and he needed more time to round them up. And Lewis needed time to arrange for the Osage chief's journey to Washington. He put departure day, D-Day, back a month. At 7 o'clock a.m. on Saturday, April 7th, Lewis and Clark set out in a canoe, with York and a private to paddle them, for St. Louis. They arrived at 10:30. Captain Stoddard greeted them and made them his guests. At his quarters, Lewis and Clark dressed, then went to a dinner and ball. Stoddard was the host. He had invited some 50 gentlemen of the city to thank them for their support and the courtesies shown to him. The ball lasted until 9 o'clock a.m. Sunday. "No business today," Clark wrote in his journal on Sunday evening. On Monday, Clark returned to Wood River while Lewis began buying. Flags, mosquito nets, shirts, food, liquor, Indian trade goods. Among other things, he bought and had shipped to Wood River, where it was repacked for the expedition, 4,175 complete rations at 14 cents each, 5,555 rations of flour at 4 cents each, 100 gallons of whiskey at $1.28 each, 20 gallons of whiskey at $1 each, 4,000 rations of salt port at 4 cents each, plus ground corn and much more. Clark sent Lewis his shopping list, nails for hinges, 200 cent, Lewis noted on the list, red oil paint for the lockers, not to be had, Lewis noted, red and blue ribbon, cent, and so forth. On May 2nd, Lewis wrote Clark to report that the Osage party would set out in about 10 days and to ask Clark to send to him in St. Louis the specimens of salt which you will find in my writing desk on the shelves where our books are or in the drawer of the instrument case. The invitation to rummage through Lewis's writing desk spoke to the absolute trust between the two men, and the sentence also gives a tiny glimpse into what their quarters at Wood River were like. Sunday, May 6th, was a grand day for Captain Clark, a horrible one for Captain Lewis. At Wood River, several of the settlers came in to challenge the soldiers to a shooting match. Of the challengers, Clark wrote with some satisfaction, "All get beat and lose their money." In St. Louis, Lewis was frustrated because there were no more kegs to be had. He had bought out the entire stock. He was furious because Manuel Lisa had evidently not gotten enough of Lewis's business to satisfy him and had therefore sent a petition to the authorities protesting Lewis's high-handedness and other shortcomings. On May 6th, Lewis wrote Clark about Lisa's actions and his reaction. He let it all out. "Damn Manuel," Lewis exploded. "And triply damn Mr. B., Francis Benoit, Lisa's partner. They give me more vexation and trouble than their lives are worth. I have dealt very plainly with these gentlemen. In short, I have come to an open rupture with them. I think them both great scoundrels, and they have given me abundant proofs of their unfriendly dispositions towards our government and its measures." His blood was up. "These gentlemen," he wrote, then stopped, crossed it out, and continued, "these puppies are not unacquainted with my opinions. Strange indeed that men to appearance in their senses will manifest such strong assumptions of insanity as to be whetting knives to cut their own throats." Lewis had reason to contemplate cutting his own throat. He had been forced to begin this letter with an awful piece of news. "I send you herewith enclosed your commission accompanied by the Secretary of War's letter. It is not such as I wished or had reason to expect, but so it is. A further explanation when I join you." It was a lieutenant's commission, not a captain's, as Lewis had promised. Lewis was mortified and apparently helpless. His heart had sunk as he read Dearborn's reply to his letter of February 10th asking about Clark's commission. Dated March 26th, Dearborn's letter began, "The peculiar situation, circumstances, and organization of the Corps of Engineers is such as would render the appointment of Mr. Clark a captain in that corps improper." The best Dearborn could do for Clark was a commission as a lieutenant in the Corps of Artillerists, which he enclosed. Clark's military grade would have no effect on his compensation for the expedition, Dearborn said, meaning Clark would still be paid as a captain. On March 24th, Dearborn had sent a list of nominations to Jefferson, including Clark's as a lieutenant in the artillery. That afternoon, Jefferson had endorsed the list and sent it on to the Senate for confirmation, which was done on March 26th. In a shifty little bureaucratic maneuver, Dearborn managed to make a bad situation worse. He dated Clark's commission as of the day he signed it, March 26, 1804. That hurt Clark on the seniority list and denied his service from the day he enlisted, and even denied his service from mid-October 1803 to March 26, 1804. As far as is known, Jefferson made no protest, whether because he failed to notice or because he approved Dearborn's decision cannot be said. It had always been clear that if Clark turned down Lewis's invitation and Moses Hook took his place, it would be as a lieutenant and he would be clearly second in command, but that if Clark joined up, it would be as a captain and a co-commander. Jefferson knew that, and reports sent to him from St. Louis and Wood River also made it clear that Lewis and Clark had been functioning as co-commanders. It may be that Jefferson wanted Lewis in sole command. Perhaps he reasoned that in such a long voyage, it was inevitable that the two leaders would disagree, perhaps sharply enough to paralyze the command, or even worse, to divide the Corps of Discovery into hostile factions. Whatever Jefferson's intentions, Dearborn's action gave Lewis an opportunity to take sole command. But he felt not the slightest temptation to take advantage of the situation. He immediately wrote Clark, "I think it will be best to let none of our party or any other persons know anything about the grade. You will observe that the grade has no effect upon your compensation, which by God shall be equal to my own." For the next 7 years, only Dearborn, Jefferson, a clerk or two in the War Department, and Meriwether Lewis and William Clark knew that, as far as the Army was concerned, Captain Lewis was in command of the Corps of Discovery, with Lieutenant Clark as his second in command. For the men of the expedition, it was Captains Clark and Lewis, co-commanders. That was all that counted. Whether Clark ever talked to Lewis about the matter is unknown. In 1811, when Nicholas Biddle was editing the journals for publication, he asked Clark to explain the exact relation between the two officers. "Equal in every point of view," Clark wrote in reply. He said his feeling on learning that the promised captain's commission would not be forthcoming was as might be expected. But Lewis's stratagem satisfied him, and since "I wished the expedition success," I proceeded. He told Biddle that in the published journals he wished to be placed on equal footing with Captain Lewis in every point of view without exposing anything or even mentioning the commission at all. Clark confessed to Biddle, "I did not think myself very well treated," but said he had never mentioned the case to anyone, not even Jefferson or Dearborn. He instructed Biddle to keep the whole thing to himself.